Indeed, the ultimate ending point of that logic is that there is no society. There is only a bunch of individual people making individual choices to promote their own individual well-being.
Next week's episode tells the story of how politicians on the left in both Britain and America turn to the techniques developed by business in order to regain power. But what they didn't realize is that what had worked for business would undermine the very basis of their political beliefs. They would find themselves trapped by the greedy desires of the new self.
You've been listening to The Century of Self, Part 3, There is a Policeman Inside All Our Heads, and He Must Be Destroyed, a video documentary by Adam Curtis, adapted for radio. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
It was a time I'll always remember, I could never forget, how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. And when the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be all right. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. For the first time, their children were proud of their parents. And somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison door swung open. Mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo-colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. George Bush and Henry Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks, organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm. after the revolution. All the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the revolution.
Next, we'll continue with another reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. John Taylor Gatto spent 30 years as a teacher in the public school system in New York City. At the height of his career, after winning numerous awards, including Teacher of the Year, he quit. Gatto became disillusioned with the system of schooling in America, which he concluded was not about education and enlightenment, but about creating a docile populace. We continue where we left off, partway through Chapter 1, with how Hindu schooling came to America. By the end of the first quarter of the 19th century, a form of school technology was up and running in America's larger cities, one in which children of lower-class customers were psychologically conditioned to obedience under pretext that they were learning reading and counting, which may have also happened. These were the Lancaster schools, sponsored by Governor DeWitt Clinton of New York and prominent Quakers like Thomas Eddy, builder of the Erie Canal. They soon spread to every corner of the nation where the problem of an incipient proletariat existed. Lancaster schools are cousins of today's school factories. What few knew then or realize now is that they were also a Hindu invention, designed with the express purpose of retarding intellectual development. How Hindu schooling came to America, England, Germany, and France at just about the same time is a story which has never been told. A full treatment is beyond the scope of this book, but I'll tell you enough to set you wondering how an Asiatic device specifically intended to preserve a caste system came to reproduce itself in the early republic, protected by influentials of the magnitude of Clinton and Eddy. Even a brief dusting off of schooling's Hindu provenance should warn you that what you know about American schooling isn't much. First, a quick gloss on the historical position of India at the time of the American Revolution. For Lancaster schools were in New York 2 decades after its end. India fell victim to Western dominance through nautical technology in the following fashion. When medieval Europe broke up after its long struggle to reconcile emergent science with religion, 5 great ocean powers appeared to compete for the wealth of the planet: Portugal, Spain, France, the Netherlands, and England. Portugal was the first to sail for treasure, leaving colonies in India, China, and South America, but its day in the sun was short. Spain emerged as the next global superpower, but after 1600, her character decayed rapidly from the corrupting effects of the gold of the Americas, which triggered a long national decline. The Netherlands' turn followed because that nation had the advantage of a single-minded commercial class in control of things with one aim in mind: wealth. The Dutch monopolized the carrying trade of Europe with globe-trotting merchant ships and courageous military seamanship. Yet, as with Portugal before it, the Dutch population was too small, its internal resources too anemic for its dominance to extend very long. Beginning in the 17th century, England and France gradually built business in the East, both balked for a time by the Dutch, who controlled the spice trade of the Indies. 3 naval wars with the Dutch made the Royal Navy master of the seas, in the process developing tactics of sea warfare that made it dominant for the next 2 centuries. By 1700, only France and England remained as global sea powers with impressive fighting capability, and during the last half of that century, these giants slugged it out directly in Canada, India, and in the territory which is today the United States, with the result that France went permanently into eclipse. In India, the two contended through their commercial pseudopodia, the British and French East India Companies. Each maintained a private army to war on the other for tea, indigo, turmeric, ginger, quinine, oil seeds, silk, and that product which most captivated British merchants with its portability and breakaway profit potential, opium. At Plassey, Chandernagore, Madras, and Wandawash, this long corporate rivalry ended. The French abandoned India to the British. The drug monopoly was finally England's. Out of this experience and the observations of a wealthy young Anglican chaplain in India, the formula for modern schooling was discovered. Perhaps it was no more than coincidence this fellow held his first gainful employment as a schoolteacher in the United States. On the other hand, perhaps his experience in a nation which successfully threw off British shackles sensitized him to the danger an educated population poses to plutocracies. Andrew Bell, the gentleman in question, used to be described in old editions of the Britannica as cold, shrewd, self-seeking. He might not have been the most pious cleric. Perhaps like his contemporary Parson Malthus, he didn't really believe in God at all. But as a young man following the flag, he had an eye out for the main chance. Bell found his opportunity when he studied the structure Hindus arranged for training the lower castes, about 95% of the Indian population. It might well serve a Britain which had driven its peasantry into ruin in order to create an industrial proletariat for coal-driven industry. Bell was fascinated by the purposeful nature of Hindu schooling. It seemed eminently compatible with the goals of the English state church. So as many another ambitious young man has done throughout history when he stumbles upon a little-known novelty, he swiped it. Before we turn to the details of the Hindu method, and how Bell himself was upstaged by an ambitious young Quaker who beat him into the school market with a working version of Bell's ideas, you should understand a little about Hindu religion. After the British military conquest of India, in reality a merchant conquest, nothing excited the popular mind and the well-bred mind alike more than Hindu religion with its weird, to Western eyes, idols and rituals. Close analysis of Sanskrit literature seemed to prove that some kind of biological and social link had existed between the all-conquering Aryans, from whom the Hindus had descended, and Anglo-Saxons, which might explain theological similarities between Hinduism and Anglicanism. The possibilities suggested by this connection eventually provided a powerful psychic stimulus for the creation of class-based schooling in the United States. Of course, such a development then lay far in the future. The caste system of Hinduism, or Brahmanism, is the Anglican class system pushed to its imaginative limits. A five-category ranking, each category further subdivided, apportions people into a similar system to that found in modern schools. Prestige and authority are reserved for the three highest castes, although they comprise only 5% of the total. Inescapable servility is assigned the lowest caste, a pariah group outside serious consideration. In the Hindu system, one may fall into a lower caste, but one cannot rise. When the British began to administer India, Hindus represented 70% of a population well over 100 million. Contrast this with an America of perhaps 3 million. In the northern region, British hero Robert Clive was president of Bengal, where people were conspicuously lighter-skinned than the other major Indian group, having features not unlike those of the British. Hindu castes look like this. The upper 5% was divided into three twice-born groups: Brahmins, priests and those trained for law, medicine, teaching, and other professional occupations. 2. The warrior and administrative caste. 3. The industrial caste, which would include land cultivators and mercantile groups. The lower 95% was divided into 1. The menial caste. 2. Pariahs, called untouchables. The entire purpose of Hindu schooling was to preserve the caste system. Only the lucky 5% received an education which gave perspective on the whole, a key to understanding. In actual practice, warriors, administrators, and most of the other leaders were given much diluted insight into the driving engines of the culture, so that policy could be kept in the hands of Brahmins. But what of the others, the masses, as Western socialist tradition would come to call them, in an echoing tribute to the Hindu class idea? The answer to that vital question launched factory schooling in the West. Which brings us back to Andrew Bell. Bell noticed that in some places Hinduism had created a mass schooling institution for children of the ordinary, one inculcating a curriculum of self-abnegation and willing servility. In these places, hundreds of children were gathered in a single gigantic room, divided into phalanxes of 10 under the direction of student leaders, with a whole ensemble directed by a Brahmin. In the Roman manner, paid pedagogues drilled underlings in the memorization and imitation of desired attitudes, and these underlings drilled the rest. Here was a social technology made in heaven for the factories and mines of Britain, still uncomfortably saturated in older yeoman legends of liberty and dignity, one not yet possessing the perfect proletarian attitudes mass production must have for maximum efficiency. Nobody in the early years of British rule had made a connection between this Hindu practice and the pressing requirements of an industrial future. Nobody, that is, until a 34-year-old Scotsman arrived in India as military chaplain. Young Bell was a go-getter. 2 years after he got to India, he was superintendent of the Male Orphan Asylum of Madras. In order to save money, Bell decided to try the Hindu system he'd seen, and found it led students quickly to docile cooperation, like parts of a machine. Furthermore, they seemed relieved not to have to think, grateful to have their time reduced to rituals and routines as Frederick Taylor was to reform the American workplace 100 years later. In 1797, Bell, now 42, published an account of what he had seen and done. Pulling no punches, he praised Hindu drill as an effective impediment to learning, writing, and ciphering. Let me read that again. Pulling no punches, he praised Hindu drill as an effective impediment to learning, writing, and ciphering, and efficient control on reading development. A 20-year-old Quaker, Joseph Lancaster, read Bell's pamphlet and thought deeply on the method and concluded, ironically, that it would be a cheap way to awaken intellect in the lower classes, ignoring the Anglican's observation and Hindu experience that it did just the opposite. Lancaster began to gather poor children under his father's roof in Borough Road, London, to give them rudimentary instruction without a fee. Word spread, and children emerged from every alley, dive, and garret, craving to learn. Soon 1,000 children were gathering in the street. The Duke of Bedford heard about Lancaster and provided him with a single enormous schoolroom and a few materials. The monitorial system, as it was called, promised to promote a mental counterpart to the productivity of factories. Transforming dirty ghetto children into an orderly army attracted many observers. The fact that Lancaster's school ran at tiny cost with only one employee raised interest too. Invitations arrived to lecture in surrounding towns, where the Quaker expounded on what had now become his system. Lancaster schools multiplied under the direction of young men he personally trained. So talked about did the phenomenon become. It eventually attracted the attention of King George III himself, who commanded an interview with Joseph. Royal patronage followed on the stipulation that every poor child be taught to read the Bible. But with fame and public responsibility, another side of Lancaster showed itself. He became vain, reckless, improvident. Interested noblemen bailed him out after he fell deeply in debt and helped him found the British and Foreign School Society. But Lancaster hated being watched over and soon proved impossible to control. He left the organization his patrons erected, starting a private school which went bankrupt. By 1818, the Anglican Church, warming to Bell's insight that schooled ignorance was more useful than unschooled stupidity, set up a rival chain of factory schools that proved to be the handwriting on the wall for Lancaster. In the face of this competition, he fled to America, where his fame and his method had already preceded him. Meanwhile, in England, the whole body of dissenting sects gave Lancaster vociferous public support, thoroughly alarming the state church hierarchy. Prominent church laymen and clergy were not unaware that Lancaster's schools weren't playing by Hindu rules. The prospect of a literate underclass with unseemly ambitions was a window on a future impossible to tolerate. Bell had been recalled from his rectory in Dorset in 1807 to contest Lancaster's use of Hindu schooling. In 1811, he was named superintendent of an organization to oppose Lancaster's British and Foreign School Society. The National Society for Promoting the Education of the Poor in the Principles of the Established Church. Since those principles held that the poor were poor because the Lord wanted it that way, the content of the society's schooling leaves little about which we need to speculate. Bell was sent to plant his system in Presbyterian Scotland, while the patronage advantage of Bell's system schools contained and diminished the reach of Lancaster. For his services to the state, Bell was eventually buried in Westminster Abbey. At first, Lancaster was welcomed warmly in the United States, but his affection for children and his ability to awaken pride and ambition in his charges made him ultimately unacceptable to important patrons who were much more interested in spreading Bell's dumbed-down method without its Church of England baggage attached. Fortunately for their schemes, Lancaster grew even more shiftless, unmethodical, and incapable of sustained effort or principled action. In the remaining 20 years of his life, Lancaster ranged from Montreal to Caracas, disowned by Quakers for reasons I've been unable to discover. Once he declared it would be possible to teach illiterates to read fluently in 20 to 90 days, which is certainly true. At the age of 60, he was run over by a carriage in New York and died a few hours later. But while he died an outcast, his system outlived him, or at least his system bearing his name did, albeit more Bell's than Lancaster's. It accustomed an influential public to expect streets to be clear of the offspring of the poor, and to expenditures of tax money to accomplish this end. The first Lancaster school was opened in New York City in 1806. By 1829, the idea had spread to the Mexican state of Texas, with stops as far west as Cincinnati, Louisville, and Detroit. The governors of New York and Pennsylvania recommended general adoption to their legislatures. What exactly was a Lancaster school? Its essential features involved one large room stuffed with anywhere from 300 to 1,000 children under the direction of a single teacher. The children were seated in rows. The teacher was not there to teach, but to be a bystander and inspector. Students, ranked in a paramilitary hierarchy, did the actual teaching. What the master says should be done. When the pupils, as well as the schoolmaster, understand how to act and learn on this system, the system, not the master's vague, discretionary, uncertain judgment, will be in practice. In common school, the authority of the master is personal, and the rod is his scepter. His absence is an immediate signal for confusion. But in a school conducted on my plan, when the master leaves the school, the business will go on as well in his absence as in his presence. Here, without forcing the matter, our modern pedagogus technologus, harbinger of future computerized instruction. In such a system, teachers and administrators are forbidden to depart from instructions elsewhere written. But while dumbing children down was the whole of the government school education in England, it was only part of the story in America, and a minor one until the 20th century. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Unless you're a professional sports addict and know that Joe Montana, greatest quarterback of the modern era, went to Waverly School in Monongahela, or that Ron Nakai, only man in modern baseball history to strike out every batter on the opposing team for a whole game, did too, or that Ken Griffey Jr. went to its high school as well, you can be forgiven if you've never heard of Monongahela. But once upon a time, at the beginning of our national history, Monongahela marked the forward edge of a new nation, a wilder West than the ever more familiar West became. Teachers on a frontier cannot be bystanders. Custer's last stand in Montana had no military significance. Braddock's last stand near Monongahela, on the other hand, changed American history forever because it proved that the invincible British could be taken. And 21 years later, we did take them. An accomplishment the French and Spanish, their principal rivals, had been unable to do. Why that happened and what inspiration allowed crude colonials to succeed where powerful and polished nations could not is so tied up with Monongahela that I want to bring the moment back for you. It will make a useful reference point as we consider the problem of modern schooling. Without Braddock's defeat, we would never have had a successful American Revolution. Without getting rid of the British, the competence of ordinary people to educate themselves would never have had a fair test. In July of 1755, at the age of 23, possessing no university degrees, the alumnus of no military academy, with only 2 years of formal schooling under his belt, half-orphan George Washington was detailed an officer in the Virginia military to accompany an English military expedition moving to take the French fort at the forks of the Monongahela and Allegheny, the point that became Pittsburgh. His general, Edward Braddock, was an aristocrat commanding a well-equipped and disciplined force considerably superior to any possible resistance. Braddock felt so confident of success, he dismissed the advice of Washington to put aside traditional ways of European combat in the New World. On July 9, 1755, 2 decades and 1 year before our revolution commenced under the direction of the same Washington, Braddock executed a brilliant textbook crossing of the Monongahela near the present Homestead High Bridge by Kennywood Amusement Park. With fife and drum firing the martial spirit, he led the largest force in British colonial America, all in red coats and polished metal, across the Green River into the trees on the farther bank. Engineers went ahead to cut a road for men and cannon. Suddenly, the advance guard was enveloped in smoke. It fell back in panic. The main body moved up to relieve, but the groups meeting, going in opposite directions, caused pandemonium. On both sides of the milling redcoats, woods crackled with hostile gunfire. No enemy could be seen, but soldiers were caught between waves of bullets fanning both flanks. Men dropped in bunches. Bleeding bodies formed hills of screaming flesh, accelerating the panic. Enter George, the Washington almost unknown to American schoolchildren. Making way to Braddock, he asked permission to engage the enemy wilderness fashion. Permission denied. Military theory held that allowing commands to emanate from inferiors was a precedent more dangerous than bullets. The British were too well trained to fight out of formation, too superbly schooled to adapt to the changing demands of the new situation. When my grandfather took me to the scene of that battle years after on the way to Kennywood, he muttered without explanation, "Goddamn bums couldn't think for themselves." Now I understand what he meant. The greatest military defeat the British ever suffered in North America before Saratoga was underway. Washington's horse was shot from under him, his coat ripped by bullets. Leaping onto a second horse, his hat was lifted from his head by gunfire, and the second horse went down. A legend was in the making on the Monongahela that day, passed to Britain, France, and the colonies by survivors of the battle. Mortally wounded, Braddock released his command. Washington led the retreat on his hands and knees, crawling through the twilight, dragging the dying Braddock, symbolic of the imminent death of British rule in America. Monongahela began as a town 14 years later, crossing point for a river ferry connecting to the National Road, now Route 40, which began, appropriately enough, in the town of Washington, Pennsylvania. In 1791, leaders of the Curious Whiskey Rebellion met in Monongahela, about a block from the place I was born. Scots-Irish farmers, sick of the oppression of federal rule in the New Republic, spoke of forging a trans-Allegheny nation of free men. Monongahela might have been its capital had they succeeded. We know these men were taken seriously back east because Washington, who as a general never raised an army larger than 7,000 to fight the British, as president assembled 13,000 in 1794 to march into western Pennsylvania to subdue the Whiskey Rebels. Having fought with them as comrades, he knew the danger posed by these wild men of the farther forests was no pipe dream. They were descendants of the original pioneers who broke into Virgin Forest. An evergreen and aggressive strain of populism ran through their group character. Monongahela appears in history as a place where people expected to make their own luck, a place where rich and poor talked face to face, not through representatives. In the 1830s, it became a way station on the escape route from Horace Mann-style Whiggery, the notion that men should be bound minutely by rules and layered officialdom. Whiggery was a neo-Anglican governing idea grown strong in reaction to Andrew Jackson's dangerous democratic revolution. Whigs brought us forced schooling before they mutated into both Democrats and Republicans. History seemed to tell them that with school in their hand, their mission was accomplished. Thousands of Americans, sensibly fearing the worst, poured west to get clear of this new British consciousness coming back to life in the East, as if the spirit of General Braddock had survived after all. Many of the new pilgrims passed through Mons City on the road to a place that might allow them to continue seeing things their own way. Each group passing through on its western migration left a testament to its own particular yearnings. There are no less than 23 separate religious denominations in Monongahela, although fewer than 5,000 souls live in the town. Most surprising of all, you can find there world headquarters of an autonomous Mormon sect, one that didn't go to Nauvoo with the rest of Smith's band, but decamped here in a grimier utopia. Monongahela Mormons never accepted polygamy. They read the Book of Mormon a different way. From 1755 until the Civil War, the libertarianism of places like Monongahela set the tone for the most brilliant experiment in self-governance the modern world has ever seen. Not since the end of the Pippin kings in France had liberty been so abundantly available for such a long time. A revolution in education was at hand, as knowledge of the benefits of learning to the vigor of the spirit spread far and wide across America. Formal schooling played a part in this transformation, but its role was far from decisive. Schooled or not, the United States was the best educated nation in human history because it had liberty. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. When I was a schoolboy at the Waverly School in Monongahela, Peg Hill told us that David Farragut, the U.S. Navy's very first admiral, had been commissioned midshipman at the ripe old age of 10 for service on the warship Essex. Had Farragut been a schoolboy like me, he would have been in fifth grade when he sailed for the Argentine, rounding the horn into action against British warships operating along the Pacific coast of South America. Farragut left a description of what he encountered in his first sea fight. Quote, "I shall never forget the horrid impression made upon me at the sight of the first man I had ever seen killed. It staggered me at first, but they soon began to fall so fast that it appeared like a dream and produced no effect on my nerves." Unquote. The poise a young boy is capable of was tested when a gun captain on the port side ordered him to the wardroom for primers. As he started down the ladder, a gun captain on the starboard side, opposite the ladder, was struck full in the face by an 18-pound shot, his headless corpse falling on Farragut. Quote, "We tumbled down the hatch together. I lay for some moments stunned by the blow, but soon recovered consciousness enough to rush up on deck. The captain, seeing me covered with blood, asked if I were wounded, to which I replied, 'I believe not, sir.' Then he said, 'Where are the primers?' This brought me to my senses, and I ran below again and brought up the primers." Close quote. The Essex had success. It took prizes. Officers were dispatched with skeleton crews to sail them back to the United States. And at the age of 12, Farragut got his first command when he was picked to head a prize crew. I was in the fifth grade when I read about that. Had Farragut gone to my school, he would have been in the seventh. You might remember that as a rough index of how far our maturity has been retarded even 50 years ago. Once at sea, the deposed British captain rebelled at being ordered about by a boy and announced he was going below for his pistols, which as a token of respect he'd been allowed to keep. Farragut sent word down that if the captain appeared on deck armed, he would be summarily shot and dumped overboard. He stayed below. So ended David Farragut's first grade test of sound judgment. At 15, this unschooled young man went hunting pirates in the Mediterranean. Anchored off Naples, he witnessed an eruption of Vesuvius and studied the mechanics of volcanic action. On a long layover in Tunis, the American consul, troubled by Farragut's ignorance, tutored him in French, Italian, mathematics, and literature. Consider our admiral an embryo. I'd be surprised if you thought his education was deficient in anything a man needs to be reckoned with. When I was a schoolboy in Monongahela, I learned how Thomas Edison left school early because the school thought him feeble-minded. He spent his early years peddling newspapers. Just before the age of 12, he talked his mother into letting him work on trains as a train boy, a permission she gave which would put her in jail right now. A train boy was apprentice of all work. Shortly afterwards, a printer gave Edison some old type he was about to discard, and the boy, successfully begging a corner for himself in the baggage car to set type, began printing a 4-page newspaper the size of a handkerchief about the lives of the passengers on the train and the things that could be seen from its window. Several months later, 12-year-old Edison had 500 subscribers, earning a net profit monthly of about 25% more than an average schoolteacher of the day made. When the Civil War broke out, the newspaper became a gold mine. Railroads had telegraph facilities, so the war news was available to Edison as quickly as to professional journalists, but he could move it into print sooner than they could. He sold the war to crowds at the various stops. The Grand Trunk Herald sold as many as 1,000 extra copies after a battle at prices per issue from a dime to a quarter, amassing Edison a handsome stake. Unfortunately, at the same time, he had been experimenting with phosphorus in the baggage car. One thing led to another, and Edison set the train on fire. Otherwise, there might never have been a light bulb. When I was a schoolboy in Monongahela, I learned with a shock that the men who won our revolution were barely out of high school by the standards of my time. Hamilton was 20 in the retreat from New York, Burr, 21, Light Horse Harry Lee, 21, Lafayette, 19. What amounted to a college class rose up and struck down the British Empire, afterwards helping to write the most sophisticated governing documents in modern history. When I was a schoolboy in Monongahela, I learned the famous Samuel Pepys, whose diary is a classic, wasn't just an old gossip, but president of the Royal Society, the most prominent association of scientists in existence in the 17th century. He was also Secretary of the Admiralty. Why that's important to our investigation of modern schooling is this. Pepys could only add and subtract right up to the time of his appointment to the Admiralty, but quickly learned to multiply and divide to spare himself embarrassment. I took a different lesson from that class than the teacher intended, I think. At the age of 5, when I entered the first grade, I could add, subtract, and multiply because Dad used to play numbers games with my sister and me in the car. He taught me the mastery of those skills within a matter of a few hours, not years and years as I took in school. We did all calculations in our heads with such gusto, I seldom use a pencil today even for much more intricate computation. Pepys verified my father's unstated premise. You can learn what you need, even the technical stuff, at the moment you need it or shortly before. Sam Pepys wasn't put in charge of Britain's sea defense because he knew how to multiply or divide, but because he had good judgment, or at least was thought so. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Ben Franklin was born on Milk Street, Boston, on January 17, 1706. His father had 17 children. 4 died at birth by 2 wives. Ben was the youngest. Josiah, the father, was a candle maker, not part of the gentry. His tombstone tells us he was without an estate or any gainful employment, which apparently means his trade didn't allow wealth to be amassed. But as the talkative tombstone continues, by constant labor and industry with God's blessing, they maintained a large family comfortably and brought up 13 children and 7 grandchildren reputably. Writing to his own son at the age of 65, Ben Franklin referred to his circumstances as poverty and obscurity, from which he rose to a state of affluence and to some degree reputation. The means he used so well succeeded, he thought, posterity might like to know what they were. Some, he believed, would find his example suitable to their own situations and therefore fit to be imitated. At 12, he was bound apprentice to Brother James, a printer. After a few years of that, and disliking his brother's authority, he ran away first to New York and soon after to Philadelphia, where he arrived broke at the age of 17. Finding work as a printer proved easy, and through his sociable nature and ready curiosity, he made acquaintance with men of means. One of these induced Franklin to go to London, where he found work as a compositor, and once again brought himself to the attention of men of substance. A merchant brought him back to Philadelphia in his early 20s as what today might be called an administrative assistant or personal secretary. From this association, Franklin assembled means to set up his own printing house, which published a newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, to which he constantly contributed essays. At 26, he began to issue Poor Richard's Almanac, and for the next quarter century, the almanac spread his fame through the colonies and in Europe. He involved himself deeper and deeper in public affairs. He designed an academy, which was later developed into the University of Pennsylvania. He founded the American Philosophical Society as a crossroads of the sciences. He made serious researches into the nature of electricity and other scientific inquiries, carried on a large number of money-making activities, and involved himself heavily in politics. At the age of 42, he was wealthy. The year was 1748. In 1748, he sold his business in order to devote himself to study, and in a few years, scientific discoveries gave him a reputation with the learned of Europe. In politics, he reformed the postal system and began to represent the colonies in dealings with England and later France. In 1757, he was sent to England to protest against the influence of the Penns in the government of Pennsylvania, and remained there 5 years, returning 2 years later to petition the king to take the government away from the Penns. He lobbied to repeal the Stamp Act. From 1767 to 1775, he spent much time traveling through France, speaking, writing, and making contacts, which resulted in a reputation so vast it brought loans and military assistance to the American rebels, and finally, crucial French intervention at Yorktown, which broke the back of the British. As a writer, politician, scientist, and businessman, Franklin had few equals among the educated of his day, though he left school at 10. He spent 9 years as American commissioner to France. In terms only of his ease with the French language, of which he had little until he was in his 60s, this unschooled man's accomplishments are unfathomable by modern pedagogical theory. In many of his social encounters with French nobility, this candlemaker's son held the fate of the new nation in his hands because he and Jefferson were being weighed as emblems of America's ability to overthrow England. Franklin's autobiography is a trove of clues from which we can piece together the actual curriculum which produced an old man capable of birthing a nation. Quote, "My elder brothers were all put apprentice to different trades. I was put to the grammar school at 8 years of age, my father intending to devote me, as the tithe of his sons, to the services of the Anglican Church. My early readiness in learning to read, which must have been very early, as I do not remember when I could not read, and the opinion of all his friends that I should be a good scholar, encouraged him in this purpose. I continued, however, at grammar school not quite 1 year." Close quote. Young Ben was yanked from grammar school and sent to another type less ritzy and more nuts and bolts in the colonial times, the writing and arithmetic school. There, under the tutelage of Mr. Brownell, an advocate of mild, encouraging methods, Franklin failed in arithmetic. At 10 years old, I was taken home to assist my father in his business. Accordingly, I was employed in cutting wick for candles, filling the dipping mold and the molds for cast candles, attending the shop, going on errands, etc. I disliked the trade and had a strong inclination for the sea, but my father declared against it. There are other less flattering accounts why Franklin left both these schools and struck out on his own at the age of 10. Elsewhere, he admits being a leader of mischief, some of it mildly criminal, and to being corrected by his father. But causation is not our concern, only bare facts. Benjamin Franklin commenced school at third grade age and exited when he would have been in the fifth to become a tallow chandler's apprentice. A major part of Franklin's early education consisted of studying Father Josiah, who turns out himself to have been a pretty fair example of education without schooling. Quote, "He had an excellent constitution, very strong, ingenious, could draw prettily, skilled in music, a clear, pleasing voice, played psalm tunes on his violin, a mechanical genius, sound understanding, solid judgment in prudential matters, both private and public affairs. In the latter, indeed, he was never employed, the numerous family he had to educate, and the straitness of his circumstances keeping him close to his grade. But I remember well his being frequently visited by leading people who consulted with him for his opinion in affairs of the town or of the church, and showed a great deal of respect for his judgment and advice, frequently chosen an arbitrator between contending parties." We don't need to push too hard to see a variety of informal training laboratories incidentally offered in this father-son relationship, which had sufficient time to prove valuable in Franklin's own development, opportunities that would have been hard to find in any school. Josiah drew, he sang, he played violin. This was a tallow chandler with sensitivity to those areas in which human beings are most human. He had an inventive nature, ingenious, which must have provided a constant example to Franklin that a solution can be crafted ad hoc to a problem if a man kept his nerve and had proper self-respect. His good sense, recognized by neighbors who sought his judgment, was always within earshot of Ben. In this way, the boy came to see the discovery process, various systems of judgment, the role of an active citizen who may become minister without portfolio simply by accepting responsibility for others and discharging that responsibility faithfully. Quote, "At his table he liked to have, as often as he could, some sensible friend or neighbor to converse with, and always took care to start some ingenious or useful topic for discourse, which might tend to improve the minds of his children. By this means he turned our attention to what was good, just, and prudent in the conduct of life, and little or no notice was ever taken of what related to the victuals on the table. I was brought up in such perfect inattention to those matters as to be quite indifferent what kind of food was set before me." Close quote. No course of instruction or quantity of homework could deliver Franklin's facility with language, only something like Josiah's incidental drills at the dinner table. We can see sharply through Franklin's memoir that a tallow chandler can indeed teach himself to speak to kings. And there were other themes in the Franklin family's educational armory besides arts, home demonstrations, regular responsibility, being held to account, being allowed to overhear adults solving public and private problems, and constant infusions of good conversation. Quote, "He He sometimes took me to walk with him and see joiners, bricklayers, turners, braziers, etc. at their work, that he might observe my inclination, and endeavor to fix it on some trade or other. It has ever since been a pleasure to me to see good workmen handle their tools, and it has been useful to me, having learnt so much by it, as to be able to do little jobs myself. As it is for most members of a literate society, reading was the largest single element of Franklin's educational foundation. Quote, "From a child I was fond of reading, and all the little money that came into my hands was ever laid out in books. Pleased with Pilgrim's Progress, my first collection was of John Bunyan's works in separate little volumes. I afterwards sold them to enable me to buy R. Burton's historical collections. They were small Chapman's books and cheap, 40 to 50 in all. My father's little library consisted chiefly of books in polemic divinity, most of which I read. Plutarch's Lives there was, in which I read abundantly, and I still think that time spent to great advantage. There was also a book of Defoe's called Essay on Projects, and another of Dr. Mather's called Essays to Do Good, which perhaps gave me a turn of thinking that had influence on some of the principal future events in my life." You might well ask how young Franklin was reading Bunyan, Burton, Mather, Defoe, Plutarch, and works of polemic divinity before he would have been a junior in high school. If you were schooled in the brain development lore of academic pedagogy, it might seem quite a tour de force. How do you suppose this son of a working man with 13 kids became such an effective public speaker that for more than half a century his voice was heard nationally and internationally on the great questions? He employed a method absolutely free. He argued with his friend Collins. Quote, "Very fond we were of argument, and very desirous of confuting one another, which disputatious turn is based upon contradiction." Here Franklin warns against using dialectics on friendships or at social gatherings. "I had caught it, the dialectical habit, by reading my father's books of dispute about religion. A question was started between Collins and me of the propriety of educating the female sex in learning and their abilities to study. He was of the opinion that it was improper. I took the contrary side." Shortly after he began arguing, he also began reading the most elegant periodical of the day, Addison and Steele's Spectator. Quote, "I thought the writing excellent and wished, if possible, to imitate it. With that in view, I took some of the papers, and making short hints of the sentiment in each sentence, laid them by a few days, and without looking at the book, try to complete the papers again, by expressing each hinted sentiment at length, and as fully as it had been expressed before, in any suitable words that should come to hand. Then I compared my Spectator with the original, discovered some of my faults, and corrected them." This method was hammered out while working a 60-hour week. In learning eloquence, there's only Ben, his determination, and the Spectator, no teacher. For instance, while executing rewrites, Franklin came to realize his vocabulary was too barren. Quote, "I found I wanted a stock of words, which I thought I should have acquired before that time if I'd gone on making verses, since the continual occasion for words of the same import but of different length to suit the measure, or of different sound for the rhyme, would have laid me under a constant necessity of searching for variety, and also have tended to fix that variety in my mind and make me a master of it." As a good empiricist, he tried a home cure for his deficiency. "I took some tales and turned them into verse, and after a time when I had pretty well forgotten the prose, turned them back again. I also sometimes jumbled my collection of hints, his outline, into confusions, and after some weeks endeavored to reduce them into the best order before I began to form the full sentences and complete the paper. This was to teach me in the arrangement of thoughts. By comparing my work afterwards with the original, I discovered many faults and amended them. But I sometimes thought I had been lucky enough to improve the method or the language." By the time he was 16, Franklin was ready to take up his deficiencies in earnest, with full confidence he could by his own efforts overcome them. Here's how he handled that problem with arithmetic. Quote, "Being on some occasion made ashamed of my ignorance in figures, which I had twice failed in learning when at school. I took Crocker's book of arithmetic and went through the whole by myself with great ease. I also read Sellers and Shermy's book of navigation and became acquainted with the geometry they contain. This school dropout tells us he was also reading John Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding, as well as studying the arts of rhetoric and logic, particularly the Socratic method of disputation, which so charmed and intrigued him that he abruptly dropped his former argumentative style, putting on the mask of the humble inquirer and doubter. Quote, "I found this method safest for myself and very embarrassing to those against whom I used it. Therefore, I took a delight in it, practiced it continually, and grew very artful and expert in drawing people, even of superior knowledge, into concessions, the consequences of which they did not foresee, and tangling them in difficulties out of which they could not extricate themselves, and so obtaining victories that neither myself nor my cause always deserved. Might there be an instructive parallel between teaching a kid to drive, as my uncle taught me to do at age 11, and the incredible opportunities working-class kids like Franklin were given to develop as quickly and as far as their hearts and minds allowed? We drive regardless of our intelligence or characters, because the economy demands it. In colonial America, through the early republic, a pressing need existed to get the most from everybody. Because of that need, unusual men and unusual women appeared in great numbers to briefly give the lie to traditional social order. In that historical instant, thousands of years of orthodox suppositions were shattered. In the words of Eric Hoffer, only here in America were common folk given a chance to show what they could do on their own without a master to push them and order them about." Close quote. Franklin and Edison multiplied many times were the result. And I was reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. We'll continue with more from the book next week. Thanks to David Rovics for his song After the Revolution. You can contact us at the program as well as download MP3s of this and previous shows at unwelcomeguests.org. For Ithaca residents, there will be a free introductory class on nonviolent communication taught by Becca Harbor. Nonviolent communication was developed by Marshall Rosenberg, who has used it to address conflicts between societies as well as individuals. The class will be held Wednesday, August 9th, from 7 to 9 p.m. in the Green Star Co-op's Warehouse Meeting Room behind the main store on Buffalo Street in Ithaca. There's a limit of 20 people. For more info or to register in advance, call area code 607-273-9392. That's 273-9392. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all